listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the era of the hit TV show may have come and gone, with only a small percentage of Americans watching even the most popular programs. We'll talk to a TV scholar about why that is and what it means for having a shared media culture. Now, the Wisconsin Republican Convention took place over the weekend. Among the issues that dominated the convention, the continued sway of former President Donald Trump over the party and continued concerns with the 2020 presidential election. We're talking about the GOP was in Wisconsin and what it could tell us about the future of the Republican Party. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the current state of the Wisconsin Republican Party? If you are a Republican yourself, how big a role do you want to see the former president play in the next couple few years in the party, in congressional races, maybe in running for the White House again? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Riley Vedderkin is a Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Riley, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been reporting on the convention, Riley, and it was all ready to rock. And then former President Trump kind of threw a curveball into the mix. Can you talk about what happened over the last few days?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I was actually finishing up a preview story for the convention on Friday, and then just as it was about to go to print, a statement from Donald Trump lashing out at legislative leaders in Wisconsin came out and kind of had to change the top of the story. But I think overall it shows that the president continues to have a really outsized influence in the Republican Party right now. And Republicans in the state are really trying to thread and walk a really fine line between acknowledging that Trump is still in many ways the leader of the party and does have a lot of influence, but also trying to look forward to 2022 and not trying to alienate the voters who may have been turned off by him in the last election. So Donald Trump blasted Republicans for what he claimed was covering up lies about the election and not doing enough to conduct a forensic audit into the election, similar to what's happening in Arizona. And the Republicans on Saturday responded and said, hey, you know, we are doing enough here. We're doing everything really that the president asked for, and that the president is essentially just misinformed and just doesn't know the extent of the investigation effort in Wisconsin.
And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who's been hiring investigators to look at the election, made an announcement after that about a former state Supreme Court justice involved in that investigation. Can you talk about how Speaker Voss and other Republicans defended their efforts in looking back at the November elections?
Right. So I spoke to Speaker Robin Voss on Saturday morning, just as the convention was getting underway. He said that Republicans are doing enough. He's already hired retired police officers to look into questions about the election. That's not only allegations of fraud, but also looking into areas of the law where, you know, things should be changed in the future, such as looking into how laws affecting ballot boxes might affect future elections and might have affected the November election, or looking into things like Democracy in the Park in Madison, where people were allowed to vote in the election, you know, take their absentee ballots and drop them off at a public park. So just looking into those concerns, and of course, hiring Michael Gableman, who was a conservative Supreme Court justice. That was announced on Saturday, as you mentioned. Speaker Voss also talked about what's already in election law, which requires a certain percentage of voting machines to be audited as part of the election follow-up. Those didn't find any issues, which he talked about a little bit. So he says that Republicans are doing enough and aren't really going to change course at this time unless something in Arizona, for instance, or other states looking to the election do actually find widespread fraud that would maybe prompt the state to actually begin re-auditing or rather auditing more machines, looking at more ballots.
Despite this, as you said, threading the needle effort, you write, Riley, that Republicans at least made the case that they're coming into and out of this convention feeling like a pretty unified party in the state. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, yeah, that's from what I heard, the party is basically unified. I mean, I think it's hard to say that the party is not the party of Trump at this point. I think most people in the party, you know, the 90, probably 5-some percent of Republicans who voted for President Trump, you know, kind of shows that the party, you know, largely agrees with his policies. Where there are differences, Republicans say those differences are minor. Rebecca Clayfish, who is widely rumored to be announcing a bid for governor in the near future, said that the differences over style, you know, certainly may be there, but Republicans are united behind policy, and that's what they're trying to aim for in 2022.
And as we wrap up with you, Riley, what kind of things did Republicans say about policy? What were they focusing at on this convention outside of the November election and the former president?
You know, one of the bigger issues that keeps coming up is critical race theory, which is a big talking point among national Republicans. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson mentioned that, as nearly every Republican did in their speech. They want to get it out of public schools. And one way of doing that, they say, is through local offices and getting more Republicans onto local school boards. So you saw social issues like that. There's a big controversy over whether allowing trans women to play girls in women's sports. That was a big talking point at the convention. So some of those social issues, there was, of course, talk about lower taxes. There was talk about, you know, from Ron Johnson about trying to unify the country going forward. There was talk from Mike Gallagher taking a really hard line on China for what he says is its role in role behind the COVID-19 virus and quote unquote unleashing that on the world. So a lot of tough talk on some foreign policy issues, too.
Riley, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Riley Vedderkin is a Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. We continue our conversation about Republican politics in Wisconsin now, and you can join in with your thoughts on what you heard there at 800-642-1234. Susan Johnson joins us now, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, what do you think are some of the biggest takeaways from this last weekend, the Republican convention, the messages from former President Trump, about Trump's role in Republican politics here in the state?
Well, I think what was the most thing that stood out the most to me was the former President Trump calling out the Wisconsin Republicans for not doing enough to investigate election fraud and the like. And then the quick fire responses that we got from many members of the Wisconsin Republican Party to assure him that, in fact, they were doing enough and here's what we're doing. And then a request to actually issue a new letter, almost patting them on the back for what they're doing and indicating that that perhaps he was wrong in criticizing them. I don't know. But I mean, I think that if the question is this still former President Trump's Republican Party, I don't know how you answer anything but yes onto that.
And there's the concern that, okay, without President Trump, you lose a big part of your base in, say, the 2022 congressional elections. With him, there's concern that you might drive off some independent voters, some even some suburban Republicans, a small number that may have turned away when President Trump was on the ballot. What do you see in the efforts to balance those dueling concerns?
Absolutely, those are dueling concerns, but whenever I consider those dueling concerns, I fall back on the idea that the support for Trump or the belief that former President Trump is the way to go is the guiding force. And there's so many examples we can point to in the state, but also nationally, that would, I think, make the case that when those two competing forces are being weighed, that greater weight is given to ensuring that the base, the Trump base of the Republican Party, is recognized and given attention.
A big part of this this back and forth over the weekend had to do with investigating allegations of fraud in the November elections. a myth about widespread fraud. I think it's fair to say at this point. Does it make sense for Republicans to keep looking back at November?
Well, I think as long as the former president keeps speaking about November and his most strident supporters keep making references to November, I think that we're not going to see that go away. And just in the earlier segment before I came on, and you were speaking about former Justice Gableman and the police officers that have the retired police officers that have been hired by Speaker Voss to look into all of this. It doesn't look to me like the state party is moving on at all. So there must be some sense amongst them that this is important for them to continue to pursue.
We're talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at this weekend's state Republican convention and the role of former President Trump in the future of the party at the state level and national level. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on continued investigations led by state Republicans into the 2020 presidential election? Do you think you're seeing the right amount? Do you want to see less, or do you want to see more investigations? How big a role, whether you're a Republican or not, do you want to see former President Trump play in Republican politics in Wisconsin and beyond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Whitewater political scientist Susan Johnson about the state Republican convention that happened over the weekend and the future of the GOP. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you consider yourself a Republican or lean Republican, do you want to see former President Trump run to be future President Trump in 2024? If you're not a Republican, what do you think about that notion? How about Senator Ron Johnson? Would you like to see him run for a third term in the U.S. Senate? How big a role should the former president play in the future of the party? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to a caller now. Russ is with us in Columbus. Russ, hello.
Hey, I was just calling because I think what will end up happening with this continued investigation would be that they will come out with more conspiracy theories and have more people believing that to think that the election was still stolen. So I think that's just a continuation of what the plan is.
Russ, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, Russ, worried, concerned that conspiracy theories will continue, maybe even get bigger when it comes to the November elections. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, I think that we've seen so many things come out in regard to just, I've been paying, you know, close attention to what's going on in Arizona with the audit and some of the different claims that come out. And as soon as one is debunked, then it seems that there's one there to replace it. And that's just Arizona. And we're hearing other states that are looking at perhaps engaging in similar audits. So I think that that's just part and parcel of the effort amongst some members of the Republican Party to keep that base energized.
Russ, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Susan, a question hanging over Republicans now is a couple of questions about will he or won't he with Donald Trump and with Ron Johnson. Let's stay close to home here. First of all, Senator Ron Johnson says he hasn't decided whether he's going to run again. And, you know, this election is, you know, more than a year away. How much of a difference do you think it makes for the race for Senate in Wisconsin, a key Senate seat, if he does or doesn't run?
Well, you know, you use the term a key Senate race, and it absolutely is, given the fact that the Democrats have a razor thin majority. In fact, only because the vice president is a Democrat, and Wisconsin's going to be a top target no matter what. But if Wisconsin is an open seat race, I think that the Democrats are going to be, if it's possible, even more keyed up as far as trying to make sure that they field a strong candidate and put, you know, put up a fight to win that seat because it's one that they think they can win. As far as not hearing from Senator Johnson, I think many listeners will recall that when he first ran, he promised to serve no more than two terms, and he won't be the first person and he won't be the last who makes that promise and then ultimately decides to run for a third term. In my mind, he's sure behaving like someone who's planning on running for a third term, holding events, issuing press releases, being very available to the media. That's, to me, is someone who's planning on seeking a third term.
And then looking further in the future, I think there are a lot of potential Republican presidential candidates who want to stake out a position in the race for 2024, but don't want to look like they're doing it for fear of offending former President Trump, who may or may not run. Can you talk about that dynamic a little?
I think that's playing out most notably with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who people have referred to as mini Trump or something similar to that. And he's walking this fine line of trying to raise his national profile while at the same time not offending the former president, as you said, because as soon as you do that, then you become a target for him. And even though former President Trump doesn't have the social media and other outlets that he used to have as far as making noise, he still can. So yes, we're seeing a lot of that. We've also seen recently, I was surprised to see former Vice President Pence gave an address at the Reagan Library, and he seemed to, for the first time that I can recall, he was trying to stake out a position that was counter President Trump in the context of January 6th and the election and the like. So I was interested to see that. And I wonder if we're going to see more people who are trying to capture the non-Trump part of the Republican Party.
We're talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at Republican politics in Wisconsin after the convention this weekend, the role of former President Trump in the future of the party. Susan, looking at Wisconsin as a whole now and our swing state status, some very close elections for governor, for president in the state. We take turns electing Democrats and Republicans, apparently, to the U.S. Senate. Can you talk about Wisconsin's nature as a pretty close call in these big elections?
Wisconsin continues, I think, to surprise people, even nationally, where there was the expectation, I think, back to 2016, when people were absolutely certain that Hillary Clinton was going to win the state. And then we saw Donald Trump do it after former President Obama doing it twice in 2008 and 2012. And just thinking about statewide, like you mentioned, there's one Democratic senator, one Republican senator. And it's just a very divided state when you look up and down at the number of people who identify as Democrats and Republicans. And it's a very polarized state. And I think that for people who have grown up and spent a lot of time in Wisconsin, it's not the state that they recall from maybe 20, 30, 40 or more years ago. But I don't see the divisions changing. And I don't see that 50-50 split going away anytime soon either.
And Susan, I like to check in with you on this. Coming up this fall, I assume you'll be teaching some students. What kind of current events and trends do you want your students keeping their eye on?
I'm interested in focusing on policy and things like that. Sometimes as opposed to we spend too much time, myself included, thinking about the political, and there's the political in the policy. But I want to see what's going to happen with President Biden's infrastructure plan. I want to see what kinds of things he'll be able to accomplish foreign policy wise and the like. So I'm going to be trying to push more policy.
And we should do that on the show more too, I think, probably. But Susan, do you see, I mean, a trend of the politics getting in the way of the policy, especially in a place like, say, Congress?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you can't do one without the other, and it would be inappropriate to teach one without the other, particularly given the divisions that we have right now and a minority party in Congress who has issued their stated goal to stop the majority party from getting anything done. So absolutely, I think that it would be naive to focus solely on policy without considering whether or not these things can actually be accomplished. But, you know, we can think about the infrastructure bill specifically in the context of maybe we will have some compromise for once in a decade.
And we just had, of course, the president in Wisconsin, in La Crosse, making the case for that infrastructure plan in a market with some of the swingiest of swing areas in Wisconsin, the so-called Obama to Trump counties. Are we going to see a lot of attention to that part of the state, do you think, over the next couple of years?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in 2024, but even in 2022, before then, if whichever party is going to win the governorship and the Senate seat, they need to win those areas.
Susan, thanks as always for joining us today.
Happy to be with you.
That's Susan Johnson, associate professor and chair of the political science department at UW-Whitewater. She joined us for a look at Republican Party politics here in Wisconsin. Coming up, must-see television events might be turning into a thing of the past. We'll talk about the downfall of the hit TV show and what it means for the media world. And you can get us started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is there a show currently that you feel like everyone in your circle of friends or family is watching? Or do you feel like we're all doing our own sort of thing? And what is the last TV event that you remember that it felt like, yeah, most everybody was watching that? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, get a preview of the upcoming Summer Olympics. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, when was the last time you struck up a conversation with a stranger about a television show? If it's been a while, you're not alone. Data show that hit TV shows, the series that everyone seemed to be tuning in for and talking about, aren't the hits that they used to be. Even shows with a lot of buzz, like Mayor of Easttown or The Mandalorian, only get a small percentage of Americans actually watching. Our next guest says that could be bad news for having a common culture and our ability to talk with one another. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does watching your favorite series still feel like a shared experience with other people? Do you miss the feeling of big must-see TV events? What hit TV show did you always make sure to watch? Do you like how many different shows there are to choose from now? Or can it all be a bit too much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Robert Thompson is a trustee professor of television, radio, and film and the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start by looking back to the biggest TV moment of all time, excluding Super Bowls, when about 106 million people were tuned in at the same time. Here's a listen.
Well, boys, it would be hard to call what we've been through fun, but I'm sure glad we went through it together. You boys always managed to give me a good laugh right when I needed it most. Never forget the time you dropped Winchester's drawers in the OR. Of course, I had to pretend I was mad at you, but inside, I was laughing to beat all hell.
Yeah, I'm laughing just thinking about it.
Colonel Potter there in the MASH final episode in 1983, 60% of households watching. Bob, that's just like, that's pretty much impossible, right, for a TV show these days.
That's right. And, you know, the amazing thing about that is that 106 million were all watching it at the same time. There was no streaming. A lot of people didn't even have VCRs yet. Forget the DVRs and all the rest of it. So that was everybody gathered around feeding from the same cultural trough at the exact same time. And I don't think we'll ever get a show. Sports, as you pointed out, that still happens. The Super Bowl a couple of years ago had 111 million. This last year was a little less than 100. But for a regularly scheduled television series, that record has held since 1983, and I don't think it's ever going to be beat.
Can you talk about some of the things that drove this change, that balkanized our TV experience?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. We spent the first 8 decades of the 20th century putting together the biggest audience, I think, in global history. The Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans, even the medieval Catholic Church, didn't have that completely everybody consuming the same thing at the same time. And starting with Hollywood at the turn of the century, back in the early 1900s, and then with radio in the late 1920s, television in the late 1940s, we built this enormous audience that was essentially the entire population. Then cable came along, and that was the first thing that began to eat away at that. That kicks in a big way in the 1980s. And then, of course, streaming. And between those two, we've taken that massive audience and we've broken it into a million little pieces.
If I'm making a TV show, Bob, how has this changed the way I try to create the show to target an audience?
Well, if you're an artist, it's good news. The sad thing about the end of the consensus audience is that we don't have any cultural glue that keeps us all together. However, let's remember that cultural glue used to be, and I remember this as a kid, shows like Mr. Ed about a talking horse, The Flying Nun about, you guessed it, a nun who could fly, My Mother the Car, Bewitched, I Dream of Jeannie, these shows that did what they did very, very well, but there was nothing on TV that wasn't completely appropriate for a seven-year-old, and therefore there was very little that you could do. With this fragmentation of cable and now streaming, television has become one of the more sophisticated, if not the most sophisticated, storytelling form in all of the country. A lot of the best television is better than almost all the movies that come out in a given year, and better than most of the novels that come out either. So if you're an artist, the good news is you can do the kinds of things you could not have dreamed of doing in the network era. The bad news is you can't get the entire population to watch it. You have to be very, very happy. I mean, if you get 4 million, you pop the champagne bottle.
We're talking to Bob Thompson, TV and pop culture expert at Syracuse University, looking at the death of the hit TV show, the show that everyone's watching. Well, fewer and fewer people are watching it over the years. You could join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. What was the big show that at least brought together maybe everyone at your workplace or in your family or your group of friends? Or is there nothing? Do you all watch your own things? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Amber is with us in Shawano. Amber, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Amber?
I'm actually a child of homeschooling, so I'd never experienced that TV show that everyone I knew had watched. And I really am loving how many different TV shows you get to hear about when you try and talk to someone about shows.
Do you end up following people's recommendations when you go out and talk to them about shows, Amber?
I do. I've watched several things that I would not have thought I liked. And I really love it when you talk to a different generation and you get to find something that came out before you were born.
Awesome. Amber, thank you so much for sharing that. Bob, the joy of discovery there. We can't watch it all, but we can find some cool stuff if we talk to different people about TV.
Right. There's so much more to discover. I mean, again, back in the network era, there were 22 hours per week of primetime, 3 networks, and that was it. You had at any given time maybe 70, 73 shows on the air. Now it's well over 500, and that's the scripted big budget kinds of things. So the menu has gotten much, much larger. Interesting that the caller brought up the generational thing. Mm-hmm. That was always the case in that when I was a kid growing up in the 60s and 70s, I'd, of course, watch the new shows that were on. But I would also, by default, end up seeing the shows of my parents' generation. I Love Lucy was off the air long before I was born, but I saw it all the time because it was in reruns and there weren't that many choices. Or I also saw, you know, movies from the 30s and the 40s. So because you didn't have that many choices, you ended up seeing a wide range of the history of the American media. Now, many people, unless they very consciously look to go elsewhere, are not going to watch something in black and white, for example, when they have an almost infinite choice of things to do. More opportunities to see the history of film and television now through streaming, but less motivation to do it when you're having a hard enough time catching up with the things that came out this week. Netflix has probably released three new shows since we started this conversation 10 minutes ago.
And Bob, you mentioned briefly earlier, you were worried about this being yet another way where it's harder for us to talk to each other. We don't have a shared pop culture in this way. I don't know. How bad do you think that is?
Well, I think we see it, you know, when we talk about the polarization of society and all of that, I think that's got something to do with that. In that case, not so much that we're not watching, you know, all watching the Ed Sullivan Show anymore, but the fact now that back in the day of network news, Walter Cronkite had the nerve to end every episode saying, and that's the way it is. There was kind of a center that we all sort of agreed on these basic reports, and we had the debate accordingly. Now, of course, as everybody has pointed out, you can find the news operation that confirms what you already believe, and there is absolutely no reason you have to go hear other sides of the story. Now, we shouldn't get too sanguine about that. It's not like back in the network era, the 1/2 hour of evening news was giving us a completely diverse, wide range of reports. It wasn't. There were a lot of things that weren't being covered and a lot of voices that were completely silenced. So I think when all is said and done, we're better off to have opened up this vast communication system to a much wider range of voices. But I think we have really paid a price in that there is no common ground that we share in terms of news and information, in terms of entertainment, in terms of anything. Mass culture was the one place we had that. Popular culture, of course, is now many, many popular cultures, plural.
Let's go back to our callers now. Heather is with us in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hi. So you asked the question, what was the last like series that I remember people chatting about? From a perspective of kind of office water cooler talk, it would be Game of Thrones. Everybody was talking about that and trying to make sure that they, you know, if they hadn't seen it, they weren't hearing the spoilers. But I'm curious, I mean, that's like mini series. Then your guest hasn't spoken about that. I remember as a kid, I'm dating myself a little bit, seeing Shogun on TV, and that, you know, kind of changed our culture in the sense that, you know, people were home. Like, it affected the economy. Everybody stayed home. They weren't going out to eat. They watched TV. And then they started eating sushi. We learned about Japanese culture. And we just don't have that anymore. So I'm curious about his take on those kinds of things.
Before you go, Heather, did you watch Game of Thrones? Oh, Heather hung up. Okay, I really wanted to know. But Bob, yeah, you nodded along, I heard, with the miniseries.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, Game of Thrones was one of those. And there's always going to be a few shows that break through. Game of Thrones, people knew about, even if they never watched it. Many people talked about Game of Thrones, told jokes about Game of Thrones that hadn't seen it. I think Tiger King really became one of the, if you had to say what defined the first months of the pandemic, it would be Zoom and Tiger King. So every now and again, one of these shows does break through. But the miniseries is a fascinating thing. Those things start in the late 1970s on network. And Shogun was a huge hit. Roots, of course, was the most watched show ever when it first came out. And what the miniseries allowed was for shows to have continuing storylines. That didn't happen on TV until Dallas made it big in the late 1970s. And even then, you could never end the show. It had to go on forever. So the miniseries, almost all of them, including Shogun, including Roots, Winds of War, all of those Thornbirds, were all based on novels. So they allowed us to have limited number of series, beginning or of episodes, beginning, middle, and end, which television didn't do up till then. The miniseries as such has kind of gone away, but now most series on cable and streaming are in essence miniseries. Instead of 22 episodes per year, there's 13 or 12 or 8. So, and they have continuing storylines and some of them end. So in many ways, what network TV was doing with miniseries like Shogun way back in the late 1970s was a harbinger of what we're seeing now all over the place in cable and streaming.
Thanks, Heather, for that call. We're talking to Robert Thompson, professor of TV, radio, and film at Syracuse University, about the downfall of the hit TV show, fewer people watching any one program, and what it means for our shared culture. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your favorite big TV show that you knew you could watch and talk about with at least most everyone else? Do any shows you watch right now feel like a shared experience with others? Do you watch a TV show in a room with people, friends, or family? Are there ones you'd like to chat with people about? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We'll pick up our conversation with Bob Thompson, professor of radio, television, and film at Syracuse University, looking at the trend of fewer people watching even the most popular TV programs, maybe spelling the end of the hit TV show as we know it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from some of you on Facebook. Katie writes, "In our house, we have fallen in love with shows that the kids and adults can enjoy. We were very excited to watch this next season of Lego Masters and Making It." Bob, in my household, on vacations and things like that, cooking shows filled that gap for us. Are there still shows out there that are trying to appeal to a whole family all at once?
Well, not very many. And as you pointed out, you really have to go away from primetime and move more toward things like cooking shows. And of course, I guess some of the game shows now, especially in the summer, ABC has all the game shows going on. Those are relatively family friendly across the board. But the idea that, you know, until the 1970s, everything on TV was appropriate for the entire audience. That's very much less the case now, especially in all of the critically acclaimed stuff, which is, you know, most of it is very much not good for little kids. It is interesting how some of the shows that are still the biggest for all the fancy stuff on Netflix, all the Emmys they got and everything. Netflix's two highest clicked on shows until they lost them were Friends and The Office. So while Netflix was breaking all these new ground with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and all this other stuff, what most people were watching on Netflix were two old, you know, sitcoms from decades ago.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Paul is on the line in La Crosse. Paul, hi.
Hi, this is Paul. I wanted to mention, you're talking about miniseries, and I want to know what the first one is and how you defined it, because David Janssen was in The Fugitive in the 60s, and that was sort of like a miniseries because everybody tuned in week after week, like to see what had happened, and then in the final episode, it was concluded with him finding the one-armed man.
Well, spoiler alert. Paul, thanks for calling in. The Fugitive, Bob.
Need for spoiler alerts on The Fugitive. If you haven't watched The Fugitive yet, that's your problem. But I'm glad he brought that up because it wasn't a miniseries in that it had the regular number of episodes every season. But it was a rare example of a serialized program. Mm-hmm. There was an ongoing story, which was unusual back then. And it was one of the first shows to ever have an actual final episode that wrapped things up. Gilligan's Island never got them off the island until many years later when they had some made-for-TV movies. The final episode of most shows, right up until the 70s, was just like every other episode. So The Fugitive really deserves a lot more credit than it gets for starting to cash in on the one thing TV is best at, which is telling a long story. By the way, that broke all records for ratings when it came out. And it, those ratings weren't exceeded, I think, until Roots and then Dallas. The Who Shot JR reveal of Dallas broke The Fugitive's record.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Robert Thompson from Syracuse University, expert on television and pop culture, looking at the decline of the big TV hit, the thing that all of us watch. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a TV event, recent or in the distant past, that you felt like was a common moment for our culture? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ellen on Facebook, Bob, answered that question about a show with All in the Family. Can you talk about All in the Family? It was a pretty big show, I think, in its time.
No, a pretty big show. First show to go 5 years in a row, number one in the Nielsen ratings. That wouldn't be tied until The Cosby Show. And in my opinion, the single most influential program in the history of American television, entertainment program, that is. Up until All in the Family, all the stuff was going on in the real world. Entertainment TV ignored what was going on in the news. All in the Family, every episode was about stuff that was going on. That was a very important show. However, it did begin to get, they had one of the first shows that had regular cursing, swearing on it. I remember watching that. I would have been, came out in 1971. I'd have been 12 years old when All in the Family started. And it was weird being in the living room and hearing some of those words. And of course, very mild by today's standards. But hearing some of those words come out of the TV, we hadn't heard that before.
Bob, I understand that, you know, where we have Nielsen ratings for broadcast TV and some cable, streaming is still kind of a black box. We don't really know how big a hit any given show is. How hard does that make it to talk about how widespread, how widely viewed these shows are?
Well, it means we depend upon how much chatter it's got on social media, which is a very, very bad way of measuring actual numbers. And you're right. The only time we know how many people watched a Netflix show is when Netflix chooses to tell us. And then we don't know how reliable that is. So we generally tend to think that some of these, Mayor of Easttown is a perfect example. Because it was getting so much talk on social media, we got, had this sense that everybody was watching it. But of course, everybody was not watching it. It was getting less than a million when it started. By the time it finally became a big hit, it was getting 4 million. But there's 330 some odd million people in the country, which means that's, you know, a little over 1%. So how much you're hearing stuff on social media means that people on social media may be talking about it, but it's not a very good measure of what the total audience size is.
Briefly, Bob, I know you have to watch a lot of TV, Occupational Hazard. I wonder if there's a show that you actually, or any TV thing that you have to watch that you feel like when it's on. For me, Packers game, and that's about it. Do you have anything you have to watch in the moment?
Right. I mean, it's really sports is the only thing that really kind of doesn't make any sense. Even the late night shows, which become old news within about 24 hours, I generally watch those in the morning. So very few shows that, you know, that I absolutely have to watch when they come out. But every now and again, a program that, you know, doesn't give you everything at once that you really get into. You know, oftentimes there's still that sense that you want to see it as soon as you can because you're looking forward to it.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us again.
That was fun. Thanks.
Robert Thompson is a trustee professor of television, radio, and film and founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. He joined us for a look at why fewer people are watching the most popular TV shows and what it means for having a shared culture. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, How Do We Know What We Know? A historian shares lessons on evidence with a murder mystery from the nation's past. Jill Lepore shares what she's learned doing her podcast, The Last Archive, tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news. Then, through the years, polls have shown that people generally trust their local government, but those numbers may be on the way down, and soon. We'll find out what's going on and what we can do to prevent it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.